Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the program today, we'll be talking about the politics of Iran and the rise to power of the current president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. He was elected president on the strength of a populist platform. Since taking office in 2005, however, he's become better known for defending his country's right to develop nuclear energy and also for his incendiary statements about both America and Israel. This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with an Iranian-born Middle East analyst who specializes in Iranian affairs. His name is Mayer Javadanfar, and he is the co-author of The Nuclear Sphinx of Tehran, a book that looks at Ahmadinejad and the state of Iran. Carolyn Graff is the publisher. It's available in paper. And as we talk, questions and comments certainly are welcome. Our guest has been regularly consulted for his analysis of events in Iran by the international media, including the BBC, the LA Times, Voice of America, the Toronto Star. He's also director of the Middle East Economic and Political Analysis Company, and he's joining us by telephone. Questions are welcome, as always. 333-9455 is the number if you are in Champaign Urbana. Here where we are. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments brief just so that we can keep moving along and get in as many callers as possible, but certainly anyone is welcome to call. Again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Javadanfar, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
A pleasure, sir.
I think that it's fair to say that unless one was a very close student of Iranian politics, that before the presidential elections of 2005, probably most people in America, perhaps many people in Europe, had never heard of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. So we ought to talk about something of his background, certainly before he became mayor of Tehran, which was the post that he had in the government before running for president. Tell us something about his family background.
Well, actually, if I can provide a little bit of a correction to what you said,
yes.
If I can update it, there were many people inside Iran who had never heard of Ahmadinejad, never mind about people who were living outside. I remember as an Iran analyst, when I was looking at the list of Iranian presidential candidates, I looked at him and he was the most unknown candidate between all the people there. So he really was a bolt out of the blue. In terms of his background, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was born in the village of Aradan, which is situated in one of the most underprivileged areas of Iran, which is the Semnan province. He moved with his family to Tehran because his father was having economic difficulties, and basically they lived in the southern neighborhood Tehran near the bazaar for many years. His family are very religious. He was a very studious child. He was very dedicated to his studies, more than any of his classmates. This is something that many of his former friends confirm. A very dedicated soccer player, and also very religious. The mosque, his father took him to mosque many, many times a week, and that is where his fervent religious ideology and also anti-Western beliefs were born and fermented. And since his childhood, he always believed that Iran's position has been fairly mistreated by the Americans. And one of his speeches, he talks about when he was a child and was barely able to read. His father brought a newspaper into their home, and in it they were talking about an unfair law in Iran, which allowed American servicemen not to be tried on the Iranian law if they did something illegal in that country. And this is where he said he started having this anti-Western sentiments. And since then, he went to high school and university. He was an excellent student at high school, and he got an extremely high mark in the matriculation exam to enter university in Iran. He got something like the 132nd highest mark between 150,000 students, which is something very, very impressive. And during his university days, he met his wife. He was 24. She was 21. And his wife is also, she's a mechanical engineer. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad studied civil engineering. And during his days as a student, he started getting close to the Islamic society of students, which is basically was very well fit for him. And he was fighting not just pro-Shah people, he was also fighting two-day party students, which is basically the Iranian Communist Party. I would dare say that Ahmadinejad, by having studied him, hated the Soviet Union more than he hates the United States. So he was fervently anti-communist, and he did everything in order to fight the spread of communism in Iran. As a matter of fact, something that has not been mentioned in the West, and I dare say that this is an exclusive for your radio, is that during the U.S. hostage-taking operation, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was calling for the simultaneous takeover of the U.S., of the embassy of the Soviet Union. Hmm. And according to the people who were with him at that time, Ahmadinejad was so incensed that the students refused to take over the Soviet embassy as well, that he refused to visit the U.S. embassy compound in protest. And this is one of the reasons why the CIA and many intelligence agencies have not been able to say with certainty that Ahmadinejad was on the U.S. embassy premises during the takeover, and this is something that we couldn't establish either. The information that I'm giving you now is very recent from one of his fellow students at university. He's basically, his life is a very interesting story. He's somebody who is extremely dedicated, first of all, to his religious ideology, second of all, to his family, and third, to the Iranian administration, which has basically given him such incredible power.
Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting because certainly when he was elected president, there was a lot of speculation about the degree of his involvement in the revolution in 1979, in the hostage-taking, and there was some confusion or conflicting opinions on this. Some of the hostages, some of those who had been held hostage, said they thought that he was one of the hostage takers. Other people said, no, we don't think that he is. Some of those people who were actually involved, known to be involved, said, no, he was not involved in this. So what you seem to be saying is that at least as far as the British intelligence and American intelligence is concerned, they haven't been able to establish that he was. I suppose does that still leave it as an open question?
I'd say it's almost a closed question. Not just because of what I'm sure that the CIA and the MI6 and the Mossad would love to get their hands on some evidence to show that he was there and to use it against Ahmadinejad. But one of the biggest factors why I also... So basically they're not doing it because they don't have it. But I'll tell you another reason why. In Iran, there are reformist politicians. Let's not forget the reformists have much better relations with the West than the current conservative government. The vice president, one of the vice presidents of Ayatollah Khatami, she was the spokeswoman of the hostage takers. She was at the same time later on became the vice president of the Iranian government. And she wasn't afraid to say that I was there. I was on the premises. I was involved in the hostage-taking. If she can say it, I'm sure if Ahmadinejad was on the premises, he would have said it, because he's not scared of telling the West what he thinks of them. Mm-hmm. And that would have really actually boosted his revolutionary credentials.
What was his involvement in politics before being elected mayor of Tehran? His role in politics, but his role in government.
Ahmadinejad was... involved. He was the mayor of a number of small cities in the area of near the Turkish border, two small cities called Maku and Khoi. And this was during the war. This is another exclusive which we revealed in the book about his wartime record, which we, using documents from Iran, we showed great contrast in what he said during his electioneering campaign and what he said prior to what he was doing. And basically, he's not the incredible soldier that he makes out to be. And during the first 6 years of the war, he was involved actually in a lot of administration jobs rather than the heroic fight to support the people in the front. He did join the war later on, but initially he was just in charge of a small number of cities, and he worked on construction projects in the Kurdistan region of Iran. After the war, the most senior position he got was that he became the governor of a newly created province in Iran by the name of Ardabil, which is near the Azerbaijani border, and he actually did a great job of running that province. They had an earthquake there, and he basically oversaw the reconstruction of the earthquake-affected areas. And this is when his star basically started to shine and people started noticing him. And when he went to Tehran to run for mayor, he had developed a very good track record as being a very capable manager. And to be honest with you, when it comes to small things, as long as Ahmadinejad doesn't get involved in big foreign politics, and as long as he's giving smaller projects within Iran that don't have nationwide consequences, he proved himself to be one of the best administrators that Iran has had post the revolution.
Mm-hmm. One of the striking things I think about his being elected mayor, this was of Tehran in 2003, was how low the turnout was. You report in the book that the turnout for that election in Tehran 2003 was only 12%.
Yes, because Tehran's residents were so sick of the fighting between all the reformists who were running the Tehran municipality before. People basically didn't care anymore. People just had given up hope. Tehran did have one mayor, Karbashchi, who was very good, but he was imprisoned later on for being a reformist. And basically people had given up hope on the reformists, and they didn't want to vote for the conservatives because they believed that the conservatives, they're going to make things worse. So they said, okay, we have two bad choices. The best thing is not to make a choice. It was kind of like a protest vote. People refused to go to the ballot boxes, and that actually allowed Ahmadinejad to be elected.
He was a mayor. He served as mayor for only 2 years before he was elected president. Was he a good mayor?
He was a very good mayor. Ahmadinejad did many things to improve the transportation system of Tehran. I give him one of the best examples during his time as mayor. Prior to the election of Ahmadinejad, all the garbage. Now imagine, Tehran is a city of something like 10 to 12 million people. All the garbage during that time, there was not one recycling system in Tehran. And we're talking about as late as 2002. Tehran did not have a recycling system. Ahmadinejad introduced that, and he really improved the part of the environment by recycling all the Tehran garbage, and also because Tehran environment was becoming really affected by it. He also did a very good job of improving transportation in Tehran. He doubled the number of buses. He helped the fire service in Tehran. And actually, he was very good at building centers for women. His wife has a lot of impact on Ahmadinejad. She's a kind of a Islamic feminist who believes that the position of women should be separate from men in Iran. Nevertheless, that the government should look after women's rights. The government should give them more opportunity to study. So he created many libraries for women in Tehran to study. He was very good at building low-cost housing systems in Tehran, which allowed many young people to move there, because prices in Tehran are extremely expensive. We're talking about Western-level prices. Something like 2-bedroom flat in central Tehran, which is not the best part of Tehran, costs something like $600 to rent. So you can just about imagine how popular his scheme was to give these low-cost housing. So as a mayor of Tehran, he was very good, which is another reason why he managed to get votes in Tehran and between religious people.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Mayer Javanfar. He is an Iranian-born analyst of Middle East politics who specializes in Iran and Iranian affairs, and he is the co-author of the book The Nuclear Sphinx of Tehran. It's all about Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and the state of Iran. It's published by Carroll and Graf, and it's out now if you want to take a look at it. Also, questions here on the program are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. In the presidential election in 2005, there were a number of candidates running, and in the first round, no single candidate got enough votes to win, so there had to be a runoff. The person who, in that first round, got the most number of votes was a former president, Hashemi Rafsanjani. But the guy who came in second was Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and I think that a lot of people apparently were at the time shocked that he did as well as he did.
Yes, there are good reasons why they were shocked. One of them is because Rafsanjani was so better known. I mean, to be honest with you, I myself believed that Rafsanjani was going to win. And when I was talking to other fellow Iran analysts, there weren't many people who thought in the beginning that Ahmadinejad has a chance to be elected. basically, this is the fact that he beat Rafsanjani was because of Rafsanjani was so corrupt, and everybody in Iran knew it. So people were they were sick of the corruption, and I think that's one of the reasons why many people turned out to vote for Ahmadinejad. Also because other contenders, people such as Qalibaf, which was another presidential candidate, and Ali Larijani, which I'm sure your listeners have heard of his name a couple of times. He was the top nuclear negotiator. He was also one of the candidates. And these people basically, like Ahmadinejad, belong to the Revolutionary Guard Corps, which is, these are the people we hear about who are helping the militias in Iraq. They have a very big military presence in Iran, and they are now entering politics. Now, after the first round of elections, because those guys, the former Revolutionary Guard officials, they didn't win, they basically told all their supporters, okay, between Rafsanjani and Ahmadinejad, we reluctantly back Ahmadinejad, because Rafsanjani, he was seen as somebody who would be against the Revolutionary Guards because of his corrupt image. So that was important. But the most important reason is that why Ahmadinejad was elected is because Ayatollah Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader and Iran's most powerful man, decided to allow vote rigging in Ahmadinejad's favor. Mm. Now, this is accepted across the board in Iran between people who established the revolution, people like Ayatollah Mehdi Karroubi or Rafsanjani himself, and many, many, many reporters who were in Iran believe that there was fraud in Ahmadinejad's favor. Or government officials even talked about it. Ayatollah Rafsanjani even went to the supreme leader after the first round of elections and threatened to pull out of the elections because there was so much fraud in Ahmadinejad's favor. He didn't do it because Ayatollah Khamenei basically threatened him and said, you know, if you do this, then you'll no longer have a power. So this is another important factor which we must take into account, that Ahmadinejad owes his success not just because people believed in him because he was less corrupt, but also because Iran's more powerful man decided to back him.
Mm-hmm. I think that certainly in a lot of things that I'd read, the impression that I got was that his victory was built in large part on the support from disadvantaged people in Iran who were persuaded that he would make their lives better. He seemed to have this agenda that was very directed towards domestic affairs. He might well have had this reputation as being clean, politically speaking, not corrupt, but he said that what he would do, he would work to make the lives of people better. Did he, in fact, do that?
What's really interesting is that when I was going through all his pre-election speeches and all his promises, you know, the words Israel and America were barely mentioned. And I think that captured the minds of many Iranian people. As you quite rightly said, he promised to cut the hand of corruption inside Iran. He promised to put oil money on the table of every Iranian. This is music to the ears of many Iranian people, because they live in a country that's OPEC's second biggest oil exporter. They live in a country, Iranians live in a country which has got the world's second largest gas reserves, yet they live in very, very bad economic situation. Ahmadinejad, after being in power for more than 2 years, entering three now, has not delivered. He has not delivered, and this is down to his own fault mainly. Because of his rhetoric, Iran is becoming more isolated. Therefore, there's not enough investment in the Iranian economy. Also, in terms of running the country, Ahmadinejad refuses to listen to other people, especially people with economic expertise, because he's spending money. But in Iran, there's an excess money supply, which is pushing up inflation. Now, when inflation is high, as in any other countries, such as the United States, we see it. In times of inflation, the Federal Reserve pushes up interest rates in order to reduce the money flow so that inflation comes down. Ahmadinejad is doing exactly opposite, because he thinks he knows best. He thinks that by just spending money, it's going to reach the pockets of the poor. That's not happening. What is happening is that he's pushing up inflation. So the little money that the poor do get as part of his expenditure, its value is decreasing every day. The purchasing power of the poor is decreasing every day. And the other unfortunate mistake that he's made is that in Iran there's a great deal of corruption. According to Transparency International, when Ahmadinejad came to power, Iran was something like the 90th most corrupt country. Now, the higher your score, the more corrupt you are. But since being in power in Iran, Ahmadinejad has basically made Iran more corrupt by putting his own people. Now, rather than fighting corruption, these people are lining their own pockets. So Ahmadinejad has failed to deliver his economic promises, which is why he's basically attacking Israel the way he is. And this is why he's talking about the nuclear program when he absolutely has no control over it. Because without that, people are going to take more notice of his failures. And if they do that, he could lose the next election.
All right. Well, we have a caller here to bring into the conversation. Let's do that here in Champaign County, where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi. There was one thing about the election of Ahmadinejad that you didn't mention, and I've heard it not much on regular U.S. media, but in the aftermath of the U.S. Iranian cooperation about the against the Taliban, I mean, that's not even widely known that in the American circles. I mean, it's commented on in policy circles, but there was an offer made to Rafsanjani to discuss, put everything on the table, and it came through a Swiss emissary, and it was absolutely ignored by the Bush administration. So the way I'd heard it explained was that because this was rebuffed, the more negotiating way that Rafsanjani was proposing was thought to have failed, and consequently, hardliners could argue against following that policy. I was wondering what you would say about that. I have another question too.
Well, let's get a response to the first point.
We have actually. You're absolutely right. This is one of the reasons. It's not one of the biggest reasons, but this is one of the minor reasons why Ahmadinejad was elected. And the Ayatollah who made that offer wasn't Ayatollah Rafsanjani. Was Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei. You're absolutely right. The Iranians in 2002, when the United States invaded Iraq, were very scared because they saw how the United States basically toppled Saddam Hussein in 2 weeks when Iran couldn't do it after 8 years. So they did make what is known as the grand bargain to the United States through the Swiss embassy. And at that time, I think people like Richard Perle and people like Dick Cheney were talking about fighting evil, and they were classifying the Iranians as evil, and they basically said, we don't talk to evil, and they refused it. And to make it even more interesting, they complained to the Swiss for conveying the message to the United States from Iran. The Swiss were just doing their job. So this was another reason why Ayatollah Khamenei decided to help conservatives come to power. Although it's not the biggest reasons, but I think America's attitude towards Iran in many cases has reinforced the position of the conservatives. This is just one of them.
I see. The other thing I wanted to comment on, and this is also a commonplace in the U.S. press and press around the world even, and this has to do with I'm informed by informed comment, Juan Cole, who's a scholar at University of Michigan. He's got a great blog that rounds this up. And he makes the claim that the translation of the famous remarks about wiping Israel off the map is actually totally inaccurate. It goes back to a line. It talks about removing or having Israel fade from the pages of history. Now, and that's not reassuring to anyone who's Israeli or even more moderate Israelis, but it isn't. What I'm trying to convey is that it is not the absolutely belligerent representation that we get of Iran as mad and ready. I mean, in fact, one can find in Ahmadinejad's discourse a comparison to the fading away of the Soviet Union, which was a long battle, but it was not at least the violence was all done in proxy wars, as it were. So that's one of the other comments. The other thing, and I'll sign off on this, is that there is a dearth of discourse, reporting even. There was a New York Times story on October 23rd about the PJAC being armed by the U.S., by the CIA mainly, to fight across the Iranian border, sort of very complementarily or parallel to the PKK over the Turkish border. We are aiding one side, and the weapons are commingled, and this is just one of the fronts, and this is in Cy Hirsch's reporting, and I'm hoping he's going to do a follow-up on it, but there actually is a proxy war across the and inside of Iran that's being aided by the CIA. So, and so we are, in some senses, already at war with Iran. I'll hang up and listen to the
All right.
repercussions. Thanks.
Well,
thank you. Just one important point that you mentioned, Iran being misrepresented, I do agree with you. In many areas, the Iranians are misrepresented, and they've got themselves to blame as well. But I think the Western press and many countries around the world have a bone to pick with Iran because of the way the government has been behaving towards the West. And it also it justifies the position of many countries in the Middle East. But I must say, as a Persian speaker, I was born in Iran, and I was raised there till 87, 8 years after revolution. I'm actually also Jewish. I'm one of the very proud member of the Jewish community in Iran, which has happily lived with Iranian Muslims for 2,500 years, and very proud of being Iranian as well. One area that is difficult to misrepresent is that Ahmadinejad's comments regarding Israel. Now, as a Farsi speaker, Ahmadinejad said, first of all, they said death to Israel, that's number one. And second of all, Ahmadinejad said Israel must be wiped off from the map. And there's no other way of translating this other than he was calling for Israel's destruction. I mean, you could only have to go back 2 weeks ago when Ahmadinejad called Israel a dirty microbe. A virus, and this is something that's going to collapse. So this is an area which is Ahmadinejad. He's a minority. Iranian people do not want the elimination of Israel. Iranian people, the only thing they want eliminated is injustice and unemployment in their own country. They want peace with they want peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And yes, they are concerned about excessive use of force sometimes by Israel from what they see on their televisions. But they don't want Ahmadinejad. They don't want Israel eliminated, and this is what they disagree with on Ahmadinejad. But Ahmadinejad believes that by being so extremist, he's going to make himself more popular with the Arab voters. He's not looking for Iranian support because Iranian people won't back him with his statements. He's looking for help in the Middle East so that hopefully the Arab street will back Iran's nuclear program. So his comments regarding Israel are what we hear, and I can say that to you as a Farsi speaker. Regarding Pejak, if I can explain to your listeners, is a Kurdish movement, Iranian Kurdish movement based in Iraq, which is basically attacking Iranian forces and committing some acts of terrorism on Iranian territory in order to get basically freedom and independence for Kurdistan, Iranian Kurdistan. This is a mistake by the United States. One thing that unites all Iranians is that no matter how bad the government is, no matter how much they don't like Ahmadinejad, Iranian people don't want to see their country torn apart. And they will stand up to anybody, doesn't matter how much they can talk about justified issues in Iran, such as human rights, such as the position of women. It doesn't matter how much they try to use whatever reason to make themselves liked in Iran. One thing that Iranian people agree with is that they do not want foreign countries, foreign forces coming in and carving up the country, because the Iranian history books are littered with countries such as Russia and England coming in with whatever excuse and basically carving Iran up. So this is something I would say that the United States has to be very careful, because the more United States is seen as a divisive power that is after the division of Iran, the less credibility it will have inside Iran's politics, the less credibility it will have with Iranian people, and therefore the less power it will have in order to convince people inside Iran to go against Ahmadinejad's extremist policies.
Hmm. We're a bit past the midpoint here. I have another caller we'll get to, but for the benefit of anyone who has tuned in recently, I better introduce once again our guest, Mayer Javadanfar. He's Iranian-born and Iranian and British-educated Middle East analyst based in Tel Aviv. He has master's degree in international relations and strategic studies from Lancaster University, as well as extensive experience in the analysis of Middle Eastern economic and political issues, and his main focus is Iran. He's regularly consulted exalted for his analysis of events in Iran by the international media, including the BBC, the LA Times, Voice of America, Toronto Star, Haaretz, Reuters, AP, and others. He's also director of the Middle East Economic and Political Analysis Company and is the co-author of a book that's about the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, and Iranian politics. The title of the book is The Nuclear Sphinx of Tehran, and it's published by Carol and Graf. Just very quickly here, and I have another question from somebody here who's here on the phone I want to get to, but it is true that Mr. Ahmadinejad is the president of Iran. However, he is not the most powerful individual in Iran. Certainly the most powerful political leader is the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He's the commander-in-chief of the military and is the person who is the top of politics and has the ultimate say in the political agenda. So for that reason, how concerned is one about the kinds of things that Mr. Ahmadinejad himself says, or do we assume that whatever he says is approved by the top religious and political leadership of the country?
When it comes to making decisions, to changing things inside Iran, the only area Ahmadinejad has absolute power is the economy. As the president here, he can make economic policies and have them implemented once they're approved by the parliament. When it comes to defense issues, such as the nuclear program, Ahmadinejad only has one vote in a body called the Supreme National Security Council. This body has 18 people in there, including a number of ministers and head of armed services, etc., etc. They make recommendations. They vote on them. Ahmadinejad chairs the meetings, but he has one vote. He does not have veto power. If, in the majority, that group approve a policy, then it goes to the supreme leader for final approval. If he rejects it, then it's out. Now, when it comes to the nuclear program, in terms of basically saying what he's saying, Ahmadinejad is in line with what Ayatollah Khamenei believes. But if and when Iran gets its hands on a nuclear program, it will not be Mahmoud Ahmadinejad who will have his finger on the launch button. It will be Ayatollah Khamenei. But for now, because what he's saying is in line with Ayatollah Khamenei, he's continuing the way he is, and he's feeling very confident about it.
Well, I want to come back to that point, but I don't want to make this caller wait, so let's get to them. Someone in Naperville on our line one. Hello?
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
David, I think you raised a great point with the author that his Mr. Ahmadinejad's role in the power structure of Iran, you pointed out, he is not the most powerful person. And the author mentioned something about his speeches regarding Israel. I think we should distinguish the ideology of Zionism, which he mentioned several times. Now, part of the problem is translations of his speeches. We get sound bites here and there, and I think if you analyze, I am no means a fan of this person, but I'm just saying I think it's very important to even Mr. Ahmadinejad knows it's a fantasy to eliminate Israel. Even he knows that. So I think, and the whole notion that just because Mr. Ahmadinejad says Israel should be wiped out the planet is obviously is a joke, because Israel could wipe Iran three times over if it wants to. So this whole notion that because he says that Israel is automatically threatened and it's going to be destroyed, I think it's just it's another fantasy some sections of this country would like to broadcast. But my question to the author is, Mr. Ahmadinejad is a manifestation of some of the comments or reactionary policies of some administrations in European capitals and here. He came to power solely based on what was happening abroad, too. We have to keep that ingredient in mind. And it doesn't help when our president gets up there and he says that, the axis of evil speech, whatever, or in Paris, how they brand Iran and other capitals. I think we have to keep in mind that there's a reaction coming from all directions, and we need to keep that in mind. Yes, he's not the most powerful person in Iran, and I like to point that out to the listeners. Yep. That's it. Thank you.
Well, all right. I think the caller makes some interesting points. You want to make some response?
I think that he made some excellent points. It is, look, Iranian foreign minister in a meeting in Jordan last year. Now, you got to remember, his boss is Ahmadinejad. He sat in a meeting in the World Economic Forum in the Middle East, and he said, even a school child knows that you cannot eliminate a country. Now, I tell you what the problem is, why the Israelis are so scared. If Iran gets its hands on a nuclear bomb, yes, I would say it's very unlikely that Iran would actually use it against Israel, because Israel has got a second strike capability here and it can eliminate Iran. And the Iranian leadership, Ayatollah Khamenei, is not suicidal like Ahmadinejad, so it's very unlikely. But if Iran gets its hands on the nuclear bomb, it can threaten Israel. It doesn't have to use it. It can threaten. And by threatening, that could cause a huge collapse in the Israeli economy, because no country would want to invest in a country that's living in under such a threat. And also, it could cause massive migration from Israel, because many Israelis might not want to bring up their children that's living under such a doomsday threat. So this is one of the reasons why the Israeli government is very concerned about Iran having its hands on a nuclear bomb, because they don't have to use it to damage Israel. Now, in terms of Ahmadinejad being elected because of the mistakes made on European capitals, that's true. No, without a shadow of the doubt, the United States and some European countries have actually helped the conservatives come to power. But at the end of the day, Ahmadinejad came to power because Ayatollah Khamenei felt that he was the right man for the right job for the right time, not just because of what America was doing, but what was happening inside Iran. The corruption was actually threatening the survival of the regime. People had gone to the streets in 1979 to expel the Shah because they thought that he was corrupt. Now they were looking at a regime that was even worse. Now, after 8 years of war against Iraq, Iranians, some of them were asking, why did we have a revolution when our lives are getting worse? And I think this is why he was elected. But one point I'd like to make to you is that now that Ahmadinejad is in power, and we interviewed ex-intelligence officials from Israel for our book, and they basically said that Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, despite his anti-Israel statements, is a gift from God for Israel and for the United States. Because the way he's reacting, the way he's isolating Iran, has been so amazing and so powerful in creating a united international front against Iran's nuclear program that Israel, in its wildest dreams, could not do it. And I'm actually quoting an ex-intelligence official from Israel who said to us, quote, "We should have invented somebody like Ahmadinejad 5 years ago. If we even could have invented him, you couldn't have created somebody as good as him." So in a way, as long as he's in power, he's actually serving many Western countries' desire to stop Iran from having any kind of nuclear program.
Now, just this one point I want to deal with particularly straight on, because the government of the United States and other governments has said that they're concerned that the government of Iran is pursuing the nuclear option. That is, they would like to develop nuclear weapons. And I believe that the government of Iran and the president had said, no, our interest is in developing nuclear energy for energy generation, and that we're not interested in building nuclear weapons. Do you, in fact, believe, or is there evidence to indicate that the government of Iran does indeed intend, however long it might take, to develop nuclear weapons?
First of all, I'd like to start by saying that it's Iran's right to have nuclear energy for civilian purposes. Nobody can deny that. The problem here is that, just like any other country, for example, Brazil right now is enriching uranium, and we don't see the international community being up in arms about Brazil's nuclear program. Iran also has the same right. Now, the concern about Iran is that on many occasions the Iranian government was caught cheating and lying. They didn't inform the international community about their enrichment facilities, for example, in Natanz, till 2002, and they only did it because the Iranian opposition got hold of some intelligence. Now, they say it's their own. I disagree. I think that intelligence either came from Israel or United States. They basically used that information to show that Iran has got a secret enrichment facility. Now, the Iranian government was caught lying, and then they started cooperating up to a certain extent with the international community, with the IAEA. After that, the Iranians were caught with plans how to make a trigger for a nuclear bomb. They had plans about how to mold uranium basically into a warhead. They were caught experimenting with high levels of uranium on some of their areas. Now, these are things that make the international community very concerned that Iran is not telling the whole truth. Now, another issue is that we have the NIE saying that the Iranians stopped the nuclear program for weapons in 2003. We have another report from the IAEA, which is far more to the left of the NIE when it comes to its judgment of Iran. The IAEA in its report in February said that it's still not sure that it has all the information in order to say with 100% confidence that Iran's nuclear program is for civilian purposes. I think this is where the government of Ayatollah Khamenei is in blame, basically. If they had nothing to hide, they would have opened all their doors and they could have had a fully functioning economy and a fully functioning nuclear program. The reason why they're not cooperating, I believe, is because they have something to hide. And because these people, Ayatollah Khamenei is one of the best businessmen around in the Middle East. This is how his government has managed to survive 8 years of war against Iraq and so many years of U.S. sanctions. I believe that Iran is hiding something, and this is one of the reasons why the international community is concerned.
Hmm. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Mahir Javadanfar. He is an Iranian-born Middle East analyst who specializes in Iranian affairs. He is the co-author of the book The Nuclear Sphinx of Tehran. The subtitle is Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and the State of Iran, and it's published by Carroll and Graff. Questions again, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Ahmadinejad, his term runs until 2009, I believe, and he could run for a second term. Do you think that he will?
I think he will. I think Ahmadinejad will. He seems very excited about his job, despite his setbacks. He doesn't seem tired. He's as energetic as ever. He still sleeps very little. He's acquired a taste for international travel, which I think he will have to cut down on because of the presidential elections. But I think he will, because he wants to continue with his program, and I also believe Ayatollah Khamenei will back him. Whether he will win or not, that depends. If it's up to the Iranian people, if the votes are not going to be rigged, I think he will lose. Because Iranian people, it's my belief that they don't agree with his extremist policies, and they are very disappointed with the performance of his economic programs. But at the end of the day, if Ayatollah Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, decides that Ahmadinejad is still the right man for the right job, then no matter what the Iranian people will believe, he will make sure that Ahmadinejad is president again.
Mm. So do you believe that in fact the top leadership, the Ayatollah Ali Khamenei and others at that level are happy with Mr. Ahmadinejad's performance?
I think, unfortunately for Iranian other Iranian politicians, there's not a great deal of competition. I mean, Ayatollah Rafsanjani is there, but his position is becoming marginalized in Iran. Actually, the cleric's position in Iran is becoming more marginalized since the start of the revolution. I think they're disappointed in Ahmadinejad's economic performance. I think this includes even Ayatollah Khamenei. But at the end of the day, Iran still believes it's in a perilous situation. I think the Iranian government wants somebody like, it could, and when I say government, I mean Ayatollah Khamenei, could want Ahmadinejad to stay around because of his bolstering image. They may look at him as some kind of a deterrence against the Western attack. And as I believe that Iran is developing a nuclear program, and I think it could have a bomb by the next 4 or 5 years, then it is possible that Ayatollah Khamenei will say, let's keep Ahmadinejad till we've reached our destination. Once we are nuclear, then we don't need somebody as conservative as him, and we could bring even the reformists back in power in order to improve nuclear Iran's position with the West. Because after the nuclear bomb, the second most urgent need of the regime is the economy, and the Iranian government cannot continue in state of isolation forever.
We have our previous caller, the caller from Naperville, who apparently wants to follow up, and I want to give him a quick opportunity to do that here on line number one once again. Hello.
Yes, hi. I'm back again. I would like to address one more point since the author was talking about Iran's nuclear capability. I think it's proper to address Israel's nuclear capability, and I think we could see it in this way, that its own capability, its secretive capabilities, I think it's an extremely negative force in the region. And I think if we are to tackle the fear of Iranian nuclear capability, I think we should address that. And I would like to know what the author thinks about this.
To respond, we should address nuclear capabilities of every single country in the world. And I agree with you. According to foreign media sources, Israel does have a nuclear program with nuclear bombs. But if we want to look at it from the Iranian angle, it's not Israel that Iran is worried about. When it comes to the nuclear threat, the country that Iran is concerned about is Pakistan, which is sitting on its eastern border. In 1999, the Pakistanis tested something like, I believe, 5 or 6 nuclear warheads against Iran, which is on their border. And this is the Iranian government basically felt threatened by Pakistan's nuclear program because the Pakistanis didn't care about what Iran thought. Hmm. Iran pleaded to Islamabad not to carry out those tests on the border because the tremors were felt in Iran's Sistan and Baluchistan provinces. And the Iranian government felt that basically it is inferior to its poorer neighbor. Now, the other issue that must be discussed here is that one of the biggest reasons why there's motivation in Iran to have a nuclear bomb, and I can tell you that as an Iranian who lived in Iran during the Iran-Iraq war, is Saddam Hussein's use of weapons of mass destruction against Iranian soldiers. You know, we were living in Tehran, and we felt absolutely hopeless. We thought that Saddam Hussein can come and drop a chemical bomb on Tehran, and nothing, and the West is not going to lift a finger. Who was coming to save us? The Americans were going to bomb Saddam because he was using chemical weapons? And many people then were saying that if Iran had a nuclear bomb, Saddam Hussein wouldn't dare to do what he's doing. And I think the West's failure to address Saddam Hussein's use of weapons of mass destruction against Iranian soldiers and some Iranian civilians was a very, very powerful motivator in Iran to support the nuclear program.
All right. We're getting short on time. I want to get at least one more caller, someone back here where we are in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. I just have a couple of comments which I'd like to hear the response of your guest. One is that Iran has said, insofar as having a nuclear weapon, is that it would be much more open, I believe it has given that impression, if the whole Middle East was free of nuclear weapons. In other words, Israel is the elephant in the Middle East insofar as nuclear weapons are concerned, and they are certainly concerned about that. Not only that, but the United States has stationed its military forces around, and we don't know whether those warships are carrying nuclear weapons or not, but it's a threat. So that's one point I would like to make. The other point I would like to make is that I believe the United Nations Security Council is largely under the control of the United States at the present time. And we have seen opposition in the Security Council to what the United States wants for sanctions against Iran. So to say that the whole world is against what Iran is doing, I think, is not quite correct. So perhaps... I guess one other thing is that I don't accept that the Israeli fears as you describe them. I think what Israel wants is control, wants to be top dog in the Middle East, and that's their main motivation.
All right. Well, again, we have about a minute or two left. You can respond however you like.
Sure. In terms of the United Nations Security Council being united against Iran, I think, well, thanks to President Ahmadinejad's extremist talk, we saw that the third round of sanctions were imposed against Iran, and the only country that abstained was Indonesia. So I think we can say that the international community is very worried about Iran's nuclear program. In terms of Israel, Israeli fears, Israel being top dog, I think there are many countries in that region who want to be top dog, and that includes some of the United States' other allies, such as Saudi Arabia and Egypt. I think you can be any country, not just Israel, and be concerned when another country tells you to your face that you should be eliminated. I think this is not just a question of wanting to be the strongest person. This is a question of fear that any country can have. Let's not forget that Israel has got a problem in the Middle East, and it's involved in a conflict with the Palestinians. But when another country, such as Iran, which shares no borders with Israel and has no territorial disputes, calls for its elimination, no matter how unrealistic it is, you have every right to be concerned, and that just not that, and that's also according to international law, which, and I'm quoting Article 51 of the United Nations here, the Israeli nuclear program, at the end of the day, our goal should be to free the entire world of nuclear weapons, not just Israel, not just Pakistan, including the United States. But unfortunately, the way we're living, the way this whole system has been set up, makes it extremely difficult. And when we have countries such as people like Ahmadinejad calling for elimination of other countries, then that actually justifies having nuclear weapons, because sometimes the best form of insurance against such people is to make sure that you have more power on them than them, and they know about it.
Sadly, we only have a minute for this question, but let me ask you, and anyway, officially the government of Israel has not confirmed or denied that it has nuclear weapons. People who track nuclear weapons around the world say, in fact, that it does. In conversations that you've had with people in Israel, do they outline circumstances under which they would be willing to get rid of the nuclear weapons that the country has?
Yes, Israel has said that, first of all, whatever confirmation that is, that's from foreign sources. The Israeli government officials don't talk about Israel's nuclear program. As far as they're concerned, it doesn't exist officially. Now, Israel has said if there is a security agreement in the Middle East and the countries of the region stop threatening basically Israel's existence and they have some kind of a security agreement with Israel, Israel will be willing to discuss this issue with them. This is not something that Israel has rolled out completely, no. Israel can't do that. It will basically alienate Israel even more in the region. And I think this is something that the Israeli government is interested in talking about it, but I think the best way we can reach that point is to reach peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and that's something I dearly hope will happen in the near future.
Well, there we will have to leave it for that for now. I'm sure we'll get back to these issues again. If you'd like to read more on the subject, you can look for the book that I've mentioned a couple of times, The Nuclear Sphinx of Tehran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and the State of Iran. It's published in paperback by Carol and Graf by our guest, Mayer Javadanfar. He is an Iranian-born Middle East analyst who specializes in Iranian affairs. He's director of the Middle East Economic and Political Analysis Company. Mr. Javadanfar, thank you very much for being with us.
It's been a pleasure.
Support for this program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute, celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign. The Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. In the next part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about how it is that we can make sure that the products that we use every day are safe. And our guest for the show will be Dr. Joel Tickner. He is assistant professor in the Department of Community Health and Sustainability and also project director of the Chemicals Policy Initiative of the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production. That's at the University of Massachusetts, Lowell. He'll be joining us by phone in a bit. Right now, though, we'll take a break for an update on news and markets, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Lernard Seed Service, an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products to farmers in East Central Illinois. Lernard Seed Service provides customer services and agronomic information to help customers maximize profits. Lernard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. Let's go right to the prices. We're in Kansas City. March wheat now trading at 11.42. Fast trade there, down 3. July, 11.22, down 8. At the Chicago Board of Trade, March wheat at 10.89, down 3.5. May, 11.30, up 25. July, 10.81, up 12.5. March corn, 5.29, down 4.5. May, 5.47.5, up a quarter. July, 5.59.5, up a half. December, 5.61, up 1.75. March beans, 13.69, up 28. May, 13.94, down 14.75. July, 14.10, down 11. November, 12.96, down 15.5. May soybean meal, 3.51, up 70. May soybean oil, 62.34, down 99. April live cattle, 90.